if you are certain that you can keep the woman loyal to the king's grace. My lords, pronounced the High Septon, autumn is upon us, and all men of good heart are weary of war. If Lord Baelish can bring the veil back into the king's peace, without more shedding of blood, the gods will surely bless him. But can he? Asked Lord Redwine. John Arryn's son is Lord of the Airy now, the Lord Robert. Only a boy, said Littlefinger. I will see that he grows to be Geoffrey's most loyal subject, and a fast friend to us all. Tyrion studied the slender man with a pointed beard and irreverent grey-green eyes.
Lord of Arinel, an empty honour? Bugger that, father. Even if he never sets foot in the castle, the title makes this match possible, as he's known all along.
We have no lack of foes, said Sir Kevin Lannister. If the area can be kept out of the war, all to the good. I am of a mind to see what Lord Petar can accomplish. Sir Kevin was his brother's vanguard in council. Tyrion knew from long experience he had never had a thought that Lord Tywin had not had first.
"It has all been settled beforehand," he concluded, "and this discussion no more than show."
The sheep were bleating their agreement, unaware of how neatly they'd been shorn. So it fell to Tyrion to object.
"How will the crown pay its debts without Lord Petyr? He is our wizard of coin, and we have no one to replace him."
Littlefinger smiled.
"Oh, my little friend, it's too kind. All I do is count coppers, as King Robert used to say. Any clever tradesman can do as well, and a Lannister, blessed with a golden touch of Castle Rock, will no doubt far surpass me."
"A Lannister?"
Tyrion had a bad feeling about this. Lord Tywin's gold-flecked eyes met his son's mismatched ones.
"You are admirably suited to the task, I believe."
"Indeed," Sir Kevin said heartily. "I've no doubt you'll make a splendid master of coin, Tyrion." Lord Tywin turned back to Littlefinger.
"If Lysa Arryn will take you for a husband and return to the king's peace, we shall restore the Lord Robert to the honour of Warden of the East. How soon might you leave?"
"On the morrow, if the winds permit. There's a Bravassi galley standing out past the chain, taking on cargo by boat. The Merlin King. I'll see her captain about a berth."
"You will miss the king's wedding," said Mace Tyrell.
Petyr Baelish gave a shrug.
"Tides and brides wait on no man, my lord. Once the autumn storms begin, the voyage will be much more hazardous. Drowning would definitely diminish my charms as a bridegroom."
Lord Tyrell chuckled. "True. Best you do not linger. May the gods speed you on your way," the High Septon said. "All King's Landing shall pray for your success."
Lord Redwine pinched at his nose.
"May we return to the matter of the Greyjoy Alliance? In my view, there is much to be said for it. Greyjoy's longships will augment my own fleet, and give us sufficient strength at sea to assault Dragonstone and end Stannis Baratheon's pretensions."
"King Balin's longships are occupied for the nonce," Lord Tywin said politely. "As are we. Greyjoy demands half the kingdom as the price of alliance, but what will he do to earn it? Fight the Starks? He's doing that already. Why should we pay for what he has given us free? The best thing to do about our Lord of Pike is nothing, in my view. Granted enough time, a better option may present itself, one that does not require the king to give up half his kingdom."
Tyrion watched his father closely.
"There's something he's not saying."
He remembered those important letters Lord Tywin had been writing, the night Tyrion had demanded Casterly Rock.
"What was it he said? Some battles are won with swords and spears, others with quills and ravens."
He wondered who the better option was,
and what sort of price he was demanding. "Perhaps we ought to move on to the wedding," Sir Kevin said. The High Septon spoke of the preparations being made at the Great Sept of Baelor, and Circe detailed the plans she had been making for the feast. They would feed 1,000 in the throne room, but many more outside in the yards. The outer and middle wards would be tented in silk, with tables of food and casks of ale for all those who could not be accommodated within the hall.
"Your Grace," said Grand Maester Pycelle, "in regard to the number of guests, we have had a raven from Sunspear. 300 Dornish men are riding toward King's Landing as we speak, and hope to arrive before the wedding."
"How do they come?" asked Mace Tyrell gruffly. "They have not asked leave to cross my lands."
His thick neck had turned a dark red, Tyrion noted. Dornishmen and high gardeners had never had great love for one another. Over the centuries they had fought border wars beyond count, and raided back and forth across mountains and marches, even when at peace. The enmity had waned a bit after Dorne had become part of the Seven Kingdoms, until the Dornish prince they called the Red Viper had crippled the young heir of Highgarden in a tourney. This could be ticklish, the dwarf thought, waiting to see how his father would handle it.
"Prince Doran comes at my son's invitation," Lord Tywin said calmly, "not only to join in our celebration, but to claim his seat on this council, and the justice Robert denied him for the murder of his sister Elia and her children."
Tyrion watched the faces of the Lords Tyrell, Redwine, and Rowan, wondering if any of the three would be bold enough to say, "But Lord Tywin, wasn't it you who presented the bodies to Robert, all wrapped up in Lannister cloaks?" None of them did, but it was there on their faces all the same. "Redwine does not give a fig," he thought, "but Rowan looks fit to gag." "When the king is wed to your Marjorie, and Marcella to Prince Tristane, we shall all be one great house," Sir Kevin reminded Mace Tyrell. "The enmities of the past should remain there. Would you not agree, my lord?"
"This is my daughter's wedding."
"And my grandson's," said Lord Tywin firmly. "No place for old quarrel, surely."
"I have no quarrel with Dorin, Martell," insisted Lord Tyrell, though his tone was more than a little grudging. "If he wishes to cross the Reach in peace, he need only ask my leave."
"Small chance of that," thought Tyrion. "He'll climb the Boneway, turn east near Summerhall, and come up the King's Road."
300 Dornishmen need not trouble our plans," said Circe. "We can feed the men-at-arms in the yard, squeeze some extra benches into the throne room for the lordlings and high-born knights, and find Prince Doran a place of honour on the dais."
"Not by me," was a message Tyrion read in Mace Tyrell's eyes, but the Lord of Highgarden made no reply but a curt nod.
"Perhaps we can move to a more pleasant task," said Lord Tywin. "The fruits of victory await division."
"What could be sweeter?" said Littlefinger, who had already swallowed his own fruit, Harrenhal. Each lord had his own demands. This castle and that village, tracts of lands, a small river, a forest, the wardship of certain miners left fatherless by the battle. Fortunately, these fruits were plentiful, and there were orphans and castles for all. Varys had lists. 47 lesser lordlings and 619 knights had lost their lives beneath the fiery heart of Stannis and his Lord of Light, along with several thousand common men-at-arms. Traitors all, their heirs were disinherited, their lands and castles granted to those who had proved more loyal. Highgarden reaped the richest harvest. Tyrion eyed Mace Tyrell's broad belly and thought, "He has a prodigious appetite, this one." Tyrell demanded the lands and castles of Lord Alistair Florent, his own bannerman, who'd had the singular ill judgment to back first Renly and then Stannis. Lord Tywin was pleased to oblige. Brightwater Keep and all its lands and incomes were granted to Lord Tyrell's second son, Sir Garlon, transforming him into a great lord in the blink of an eye. His elder brother, of course, stood to inherit Highgarden itself. Lesser tracts were granted to Lord Rowan and set aside for Lord Tarley, Lady Oakheart, Lord Hightower, and other worthies not present. Lord Redwine asked only for 30 years' remission of the taxes that Littlefinger and his wine factors had levied on certain of the Arbor's finest vintages. When that was granted, he pronounced himself well satisfied and suggested that they send for a cask of Arbor gold to toast good King Joffrey and his wise and benevolent hand. At that, Cersei lost patience. "It's swords Joff needs, not toasts," she snapped. "His realm is still plagued with would-be usurpers and self-styled kings."
"But not for long, I think," said Varys, anxiously.
"A few more items remain, my lords." Sir Kevin consulted his papers. "Sir Adam has found some crystals from the High Septon's crown. It appears now that the thieves broke up the crystals and melted down the gold.
Our Father above knows their guilt, and will sit in judgment on them all," the High Septon said piously.
"No doubt he will," said Lord Tywin. "All the same, you must be crowned at the king's wedding. Cersei, summon your goldsmiths. We must see to a replacement."
He did not wait for her reply, but turned at once to Varys.
"You have reports?"
The eunuch drew a parchment from his sleeve.
A kraken has been seen off the fingers," he giggled. Not a grey joy, mind you, a true kraken. It attacked an Ebony's whaler and pulled it under. There is fighting on the Stepstones, and a new war between Tyrosh and Lys seems likely. Both hope to win Myr as ally. Sailors back from the Jade Sea report that a three-headed dragon has hatched in Karth, and is the wonder of that city.
"Dragons and krakens do not interest me, regardless of the number of their heads," said Lord Tywin. "Have your whisperers perchance found some trace of my brother's son?"
"Alas, our beloved Tyrek has quite vanished. The poor, brave lad."
Varys sounded close to tears. "Tywin," Sir Kevin said before Lord Tywin could vent his obvious displeasure, "some of the gold cloaks who deserted during the battle have drifted back to barracks, thinking to take up duty once again. Sir Adam wishes to know what to do with them." "They might have endangered Joff with their cowardice," Cersei said at once. "I want them put to death." Varys sighed.
"They have surely earned death, Your Grace. None can deny it, and yet perhaps we might be wiser to send them to the Night's Watch. We have had disturbing messages from the Wall of late, of wildlings astir."
"Wildlings? Krakens and dragons?"
Mace Tyrell chuckled.
"Why, is there anyone not stirring?"
Lord Tywin ignored that.
"The Lysertres serve us better as a lesson. Break their knees with hammers. They will not run again, nor will any man who sees them begging in the streets."
He glanced down the table to see if any of the other lords disagreed. Tyrion remembered his own visit to the Wall, and the crabs he'd shared with old Lord Mormont and his officers. He remembered the old bear's fears as well.
"Perhaps we might break the knees of a few to make our point. Those who kill Sir Jocelyn, say. The rest we can send to Marsh. The Watch is grievously under strength. If the Wall should fail,
the wildlings will flood the north,"
his father finished.
"And the Starks and Greyjoys will have another enemy to contend with. They no longer wish to be subject to the Iron Throne, it would seem. So by what right do they look to the Iron Throne for aid? King Robb and King Balin both claim the North. Let them defend it, if they can. And if not, this manse raider might even prove a useful ally.
Lord Tywin looked to his brother.
Is there more?
Sir Kevin shook his head.
We are done. My lords, His Grace King Joffrey would no doubt wish to thank you all for your wisdom and good counsel.
I should like private words with my children, said Lord Tywin, as the others rose to leave. You as well, Kevin.
Obediently, the other counsellors made their farewells, Varys the first to depart, and Tyrell and Redwine the last. When the chamber was empty but for the four Lannisters, Sir Kevin closed the door.
"Master of Coin?" said Tyrion, in a thin, strained voice. "Whose notion was that, pray?"
"Lord Petyr's," his father said. "But it serves us well to have the treasury in the hands of a Lannister. You have asked for important work. Do you fear you might be incapable of the task?"
"No," said Tyrion. "I fear a trap. Littlefinger is subtle and ambitious. I do not trust him, nor should you."
"He won Highgarden to our side," Cersei began.
"And so do you, Ned Stark, I know. He will sell us just as quick. A coin is as dangerous as a sword in the wrong hands."
His uncle Kevin looked at him oddly. "Not to us, surely. The gold of Castle Rock
is dug from the ground. Littlefinger's gold is made from thin air, with a snap of his fingers."
"A more useful skill than any of yours, sweet brother," purred Cersei, in a voice sweet with malice. "Littlefinger is a liar."
"And black as well," said the raven of the crow.
Lord Tywin slammed his hand down on the table.
"Enough. I will have no more of this unseemly squabbling. You are both Lannisters, and will comport yourself as such."
Sir Kevin cleared his throat.
"I would sooner have Petyr Baelish ruling the Eyrie than any of Lady Lysa's other suitors, Jon Royce, Lynn Corbray, Horton Redford. These are dangerous men, each in his own way, and proud.
Littlefinger may be clever, but he is neither high birth nor skill at arms. The Lords of the Vale will never accept such as their liege." He looked to his brother. When Lord Tywin nodded, he continued,
"And there is this. Lord Petyr continues to demonstrate his loyalty. Only yesterday he brought us word of a Tyrell plot to spirit Sansa Stark off to Highgarden for a visit, and there marry her to Lord Mace's eldest son, Willis."
"Littlefinger brought you word?"
Tyrion leaned against the table.
"Not a master of whisperers? How interesting."
Cersei looked at their uncle in disbelief. "Sansa is my hostage. She goes nowhere without my leave."
"Leave, you must perforce grant, should Lord Tyrell ask," their father pointed out. "To refuse him would be tantamount to declaring that we did not trust him. He would take offence."
"Let him. What do we care?"
"Bloody fool," thought Tyrion. "Sweet sister," he explained patiently. "Offend Tyrell, and you offend Redwine, Tarly, Rowan, and Hightower as well, and perhaps start them wondering whether Robb Stark might not be more accommodating to their desires."
"I will not have the Rose and the Direwolf in bed together," declared Lord Tywin. "We must forestall him."
"How?"
asked Cersei.
"By marriage. Yours, to begin with."
It came so suddenly that Cersei could only stare for a moment. Then her cheeks reddened, as if she'd been slapped.
"No, not again. I will not."
"Your Grace," said Sir Kevin courteously, "you are a young woman, still fair and fertile. Surely you cannot wish to spend the rest of your days alone, and a new marriage would put to rest this talk of incest for good and all."
"So long as you remain unwed, you allow Stannis to spread his disgusting slander,"
Lord Tywin told his daughter.
"You must have a new husband in your bed, to father children on you."
"Three children is quite sufficient. I am Queen of the Seven Kingdoms, not a brood mare, the Queen Regent."
"You are my daughter, and will do as I command."
She stood. "I will not sit here and listen to this.
You will, if you wish to have any voice in the choice of your next husband,"
Lord Tywin said calmly. When she hesitated, then sat, Tyrion knew she was lost, despite her loud declaration of, "I will not marry again."
"You will marry, and you will breed. Every child you birth makes Stannis more a liar."
Their father's eyes seemed to pin her to her chair.
"Mace Tyrell, Baxter Redwine, and Dorin Martell are wed to younger women likely to outlive them. Balon Greyjoy's wife is elderly and failing, but such a match would commit us to an alliance with the Iron Islands, and I am still uncertain whether that would be our wisest course."
"No," Cersei said between white lips. "No, no, no." Tyrion could not quite suppress the grin that came to his lips at the thought of packing his sister off to Pike. "Just when I was about to give up praying, some sweet god gives me this." Lord Tywin went on.
"Oberyn Martell might suit, but the Tyrells would take that very ill. So we must look to the sons. I assume you do not object to wedding a man younger than yourself."
"I object to wedding any.
I have considered the Redwine twins, Theon Greyjoy, Quentin Martell, and a number of others. But our alliance with Highgarden was the sword that broke Stannis. It should be tempered and made stronger. Sir Loras has taken the White, and Sir Garland is wed to one of the Fosseways. But there remains the eldest son, the boy they scheme to wed to Sansa Stark."
"Willis Tyrell?"
Tyrion was taking a wicked pleasure in Cersei's helpless fury.
"That would be the cripple," he said.
Their father chilled him with a look.
"Willis is heir to Highgarden, and by all reports a mild and courtly young man, fond of reading books and looking at the stars. He has a passion for breeding animals as well, and owns the finest hounds, hawks, and horses in the Seven Kingdoms."
"A perfect match," mused Tyrion. "Cersei also has a passion for breeding."
He pitied poor Willis Tyrell, and did not know whether he wanted to laugh at his sister or weep for her.
"The Tyrell heir would be my choice," Lord Tywin concluded. "But if you would prefer another, I will hear your reasons."
"That is so very kind of you, father," Cersei said with icy courtesy. "It is such a difficult choice you give me. Who would I sooner take to bed, the old squid or the crippled dog boy? I shall need a few days to consider. Do I have your leave to go?"
"You are the queen," Tyrion wanted to tell her. "He ought to be begging leave of you."
"Go," their father said. "We shall talk again after you have composed yourself. Remember your duty."
Cersei swept stiffly from the room, her rage plain to see.
Yet in the end, she will do as father bid. She had proved that with Robert, though there is Jaime to consider.
Their brother had been much younger when Cersei wed the first time. He might not acquiesce to a second marriage quite so easily. The unfortunate Willis Tyrell was like to contract a sudden fatal case of sword through bowels, which could rather sour the alliance between Highgarden and Casterly Rock.
"I should say something, but what?" "Pardon me, father, but it's her brother she wants to marry."
"Tyrion?"
He gave a resigned smile.
"Do I hear the herald summoning me to the lists?"
"Your whoring is a weakness in you," Lord Tywin said without preamble. "But perhaps some share of the blame is mine. Since you stand no taller than a boy, I have found it easy to forget that you are in truth a man grown, with all of a man's baser needs. It is past time you were wed."
I was wed. Or have you forgotten? Tyrion's mouth twisted, and the noise emerged that was only half laugh and half snarl.
Does the prospect of marriage amuse you?
Only imagining what a bugger-all handsome bridegroom I'll make. A wife might be the very thing he needed. If she brought him lands and a keep, it would give him a place in the world apart from Joffrey's court and away from Cersei and their father. On the other hand, there was Shay.
She will not like this, for all she swears that she is content to be my whore.
That was scarcely a point to sway his father, however, so Tyrion squirmed higher in his seat and said,
"You mean to wed me to Sansa Stark? But won't the Tyrells take the match as an affront, if they have designs on the girl?"
"Lord Tyrell will not broach the matter of the Stark girl until after Joffrey's wedding. If Sansa is wed before that, how can he take offence, when he gave us no hint of his intentions?"
"Quite so," said Sir Kevin, "and any lingering resentments should be soothed by the offer of Cersei for his Willis." Tyrion rubbed at the raw stub of his nose. The scar tissue itched abominably sometimes. "His Grace, the royal pustule, has made Sansa's life a misery since the day her father died. And now that she is finally rid of Joffrey, you propose to marry her to me? That seems singularly cruel, even for you, father."
"Why? Do you plan to mistreat her?"
His father sounded more curious than concerned.
"The girl's happiness is not my purpose, nor should it be yours. Our alliances in the south may be solid as costly rock, but there remains the north to win, and the key to the north is Sansa Stark."
"She is no more than a child."
"Your sister swears she's flowered. If so, she is a woman, fit to be wed. You must needs take her maidenhead, so no man can say the marriage was not consummated. Now, after that, if you prefer to wait a year or two before bedding her again, you would be within your rights as her husband."
"Shay is all the woman I need just now," he thought, "and Sansa's a girl, no matter what you say. If your purpose here is to keep her from the Tyrells, why not return her to her mother? Perhaps that would convince Robb Stark to bend the knee." Lord Tywin's look was scornful.
"Send her to River Run, and her mother will match her with a Blackwood or a Malister to shore up her son's alliances along the Trident. Send her north, and she will be wed to some Manderly or Umber before the moon turns. Yet she is no less dangerous here at court, as this business with the Tyrell should prove. She must marry a Lannister, and soon."
"The man who wed Sansa Stark can claim Winterfell in her name," his uncle Kevin put in. "Had that not occurred to you?"
"If you will not have the girl, we shall give her to one of your cousins," said his father. "Kevin, is Lancel strong enough to wed, do you think?"
Sir Kevin hesitated. "If we bring the girl to his bedside, he could say the words, but to consummate, no. I would suggest one of the twins, but the Starks hold them both at River Run. They have Jenna's boy, Tyrion, as well, else he might serve." Tyrion let them have their byplay. It was all for his benefit, he knew.
"Sansa Stark," he mused.
Soft-spoken, sweet-smelling Sansa, who loves silks, songs, chivalry, and tall, gallant knights with handsome faces. He felt as though he was back on the bridge of boats, the deck shifting beneath his feet.
"You have asked me to reward you for your efforts in the battle," Lord Tywin reminded him forcefully. "This is a chance for you, Tyrion, the best you are ever likely to have."
He drummed his fingers impatiently on the table.
"I once hoped to marry your brother to Lysa Tully, but Aerys named Jaime to his king's guard
before the arrangements were complete. When I suggested to Lord Huster that Lysa might be wed to you instead, he replied that he wanted a whole man for his daughter.
So he wed her to John Aaron, who was old enough to be her grandfather. Tyrion was more inclined to be thankful than angry, considering what Lysa Aaron had become.
When I offered you to Dorne, I was told that the suggestion was an insult, Lord Tywin continued. In later years, I had similar answers from John Royce and Leighton Hightower. I finally stooped so low as to suggest you might take the Florent girl, Robert de Flard, in his brother's wedding bed. But her father preferred to give her to one of his own household knights. If you will not have the Stark girl, I shall find you another wife. Somewhere in the realm there is doubtless some little lordling who'd gladly part with a daughter to win the friendship of Casterly Rock. Lady Tender has offered lollies.
Tyrion gave a shudder of dismay. I'd sooner cut it off and feed it to the goats.
Then open your eyes. The Stark girl is young, nubile, tractable, of the highest birth, and still a maid. She is not uncomely. Why would you hesitate?
Why, indeed? A quirk of mine. Strange to say, I would prefer a wife who wants me in her bed.
If you think your whores want you in their bed, you are an even greater fool than I suspected, said Lord Tywin. You disappoint me, Tyrion. I had hoped this match would please you.
Yes, we all know how important my pleasure is to you, Father, but there's more to this. The key to the North, you say. The Greyjoys hold the North now, and King Balin has a daughter. Why Sansa Stark, and not her? He looked into his father's cool green eyes with a bright flecks of gold. Lord Tywin steepled his fingers beneath his chin.
Balin Greyjoy thinks in terms of plunder, not rule. Let him enjoy an autumn crown and suffer a northern winter. He will give his subjects no cause to love him. Come spring, the Northmen will have had a bellyful of krakens. When you bring Eddard Stark's grandson home to claim his birthright, lords and little folk alike will rise as one to place him on the high seat of his ancestors. You are capable of getting a woman with child, I hope.
I believe I am, he said, bristling. I confess I cannot prove it, though no one can say I have not tried. Why, I plant my little seeds just as often as I can.
In the gutters and the ditches, finished Lord Tywin, and in common ground, where only bastard weeds take root. It is past time you kept your own garden.
He rose to his feet.
You shall never have Casterly Rock, I promise you. But wed Sansa Stark, and it is just possible that you might win a Winterfell.
Tyrion Lannister, Lord Protector of Winterfell. The prospect gave him a queer chill. Very good, Father, he said slowly. But there's a big, ugly roach in your rushes. Robb Stark is as capable as I am, presumably, and sworn to marry one of those fertile Freys. And once the young wolf sires a litter, any pups that Sansa births are heirs to nothing. Lord Tywin was unconcerned.
Robb Stark will father no children on his fertile Frey, you have my word. There is a bit of news I have not yet seen fit to share with the council, though no doubt the good lords will hear it soon enough. The young wolf has taken Gawain Westerling's eldest daughter to wife.
For a moment Tyrion could not believe he'd heard his father right.
He broke his sworn word, he said incredulous. He threw away the phrase for...
Words failed him. "A maid of 16 years, named Jane," said Sir Kevin. "Lord Gawain once suggested her to me for Willem or Martin, but I had to refuse him. Gawain is a good man, but his wife is Sybil Spicer. He should never have wed her. The Westlings always did have more honour than sense. Lady Sybil's grandfather was a trader in saffron and pepper, almost as low-born as that smuggler Stannis keeps. And the grandmother was some woman he'd brought back from the East, a frightening old crone, supposed to be a priestess. Meiji, they called her. No one could pronounce her real name. Half of Lannisport used to go to her for cures and love potions and the like." He shrugged. "She is long dead, to be sure. And Jane seemed a sweet child, I'll grant you, though I only saw her once, but with such doubtful blood. Having once married a whore, Tyrion could not entirely share his uncle's horror at the thought of wedding a girl whose great-grandfather sold cloves. Even so, a sweet child, Sir Kevin had said. But many a poison was sweet as well. The Westlings were old blood, but they had more pride than power. It would not surprise him to learn that Lady Sybil had brought more wealth to the marriage than her high-born husband. The Westerling mines had failed years ago. Their best lands had been sold off or lost, and the crag was more ruin than stronghold. A romantic ruin, though, jutting up so brave above the sea. I am surprised, Tyrion had to confess. I thought Robb Stark had better sense.
He's a boy of 16, said Lord Tywin. At that age, sense weighs for little against lust and love and honour.
He forswore himself, shamed an ally, betrayed a solemn promise. Where is the honour in that? Sir Kevin answered. He chose the girl's honour over his own. Once he had deflowered her, he had no other course. It would have been kinder to leave her with a bastard in her belly, said Tyrion bluntly. The Westlings stood to lose everything here, their lands, their castle, their very lives.
A Lannister always pays his debts.
Jane Westling is her mother's daughter, said Lord Tywin, and Robb Stark is his father's son.
This Westling betrayal did not seem to have enraged his father as much as Tyrion would have expected. Lord Tywin did not suffer disloyalty in his vassals. He had extinguished the proud reigns of Castamere and the ancient Tarbecks of Tarbeck Hall, root and branch, when he was still half a boy. The singers had even made a rather gloomy song of it. Some years later, when Lord Farman of Faircastle grew truculent, Lord Tywin sent an envoy bearing a lute instead of a letter. But once he'd heard the reigns of Castamere echoing through his halls, Lord Farman gave no further trouble. And if the song were not enough, the shattered castles of the reigns and Tarbecks still stood as mute testimony to the fate that awaited those who chose to scorn the power of Casterly Rock. "The crag is not so far from Tarbeck Hall and Castamere," Tyrion pointed out. "You'd think the Westlings might have ridden past and seen the lesson there."
"Mayhaps they have," Lord Tywin said. "They are well aware of Castamere, I promise you."
"Could the Westlings and Spicers be such great fools as to believe the wolf can defeat the lion?" Every once in a very long while, Lord Tywin Lannister would actually threaten to smile. He never did, but the threat alone was terrible to behold.
"The greatest fools are oft times more clever than the men who laugh at them," he said. "And then, you will marry Sansa Stark, Tyrion. And soon."
Catelyn. They carried the corpses in upon their shoulders and laid them beneath the dais. A silence fell across the torch-lit hall, and in the quiet Catelyn could hear Grey Wind howling half a castle away. "He smells the blood," she thought. Through stone walls and wooden doors, through night and rain, he still knows the scent of death and ruin. She stood at Rob's left hand beside the high seat, and for a moment felt almost as if she were looking down at her own dead, at Bran and Rickon. These boys had been much older, but death had shrunken them. Naked and wet, they seemed such little things. So still, it was hard to remember them living. The blond boy had been trying to grow a beard. Pale yellow peach fuzz covered his cheeks and jaw above the red ruin the knife had made of his throat. His long golden hair was still wet, as if he had been pulled from a bath. By the look of him, he had died peacefully, perhaps in sleep. But his brown-haired cousin had fought for life. His arms bore slashes where he'd tried to block the blades, and red still trickled slowly from the stab wounds that covered his chest and belly and back, like so many tongueless mouths, though the rain had washed him almost clean. Rob had donned his crown before coming to the hall, and the bronze shone darkly in the torchlight. Shadows hid his eyes as he looked upon the dead. Does he see Bran and Rickon as well? She might have wept, but there were no tears left in her. The dead boys were pale from long imprisonment, and both had been fair. Against their smooth white skin, the blood was shockingly red, unbearable to look upon. Will they lay Sansa down naked beneath the Iron Throne after they've killed her? Will her skin seem as white, her blood as red? From outside came the steady wash of rain and the restless howling of a wolf. Her brother Edmure stood to Rob's right, one hand upon the back of his father's seat, his face still puffy from sleep. They had woken him, as they had her, pounding on his door in the black of night to yank him rudely from his dreams. Were they good dreams, brother? Do you dream of sunlight and laughter and a maiden's kisses? I pray you do. Her own dreams were dark and laced with terrors. Rob's captains and lords' bannermen stood about the hall, some mailed and armed, others in various states of dishevelment and undress. Sir Reynold and his uncle Sir Rolf were among them, but Rob had seen fit to spare his queen this ugliness. "The crag is not far from Castle Rock," Catelyn recalled. "Jane may well have played with his boys when all of them were children." She looked down again upon the corpses of the squires, Tion Frey and Willem Lannister, and waited for her son to speak. It seemed a very long time before Rob lifted his eyes from the bloody dead. "Small John," he said, "tell your father to bring them in." Wordless, Small John Umber turned to obey, his steps echoing in the great stone hall. As the great John marched his prisoners through the doors, Catelyn made note of how some other men stepped back to give them room, as if treason could somehow be passed by a touch, a glance, a cough. The captors and the captives looked very much alike, big men every one, with thick beards and long hair. Two of the great John's men were wounded, and three of their prisoners. Only the fact that some had spears and others empty scabbards served to set them apart. All were clad in mail hauberks or shirts of sewn rings, with heavy boots and thick cloaks, some of wool and some of fur. "The North is hard and cold, and has no mercy," Ned had told her when she first came to Winterfell 1,000 years ago. "Five," said Rob when the prisoner stood before him, wet and silent. "Is that all of them?"
"There were eight," rumbled the great John. "We killed two taking them, and a third is dying now."
Rob studied the faces of the captives. "It required eight of you to kill two unarmed squires?" Edmure Tully spoke up.
"They murdered two of my men as well to get into the tower, Delp and Elwood."
"It was no murder, sir," said Lord Rickard Carstock, no more discomforted by the ropes about his wrist than by the blood that trickled down his face. "Any man who steps between a father and his vengeance asks for death. His words rang against Catelyn's ears, harsh and cruel as the pounding of a war drum. Her throat was dry as bone. I did this. These two boys died, so my daughters might live. I saw your sons die that night in the Whispering Wood, Rob told Lord Carstark. Teon Frey did not kill Torrin. Willem Lannister did not slay Eddard. How, then, can you call this vengeance? This was folly and bloody murder. Your sons died honourably on a battlefield with swords in their hands. They died, said Rickard Carstark, yielding no inch of ground. The Kingslayer cut them down. These two were of his ilk. Only blood can pay for blood. The blood of children? Rob pointed at the corpses. How old were they? 12, 13? Squires. Squires die in every battle. Die fighting, yes. Teon Frey and Willem Lannister gave up their swords in the Whispering Wood. They were captives, locked in a cell, asleep, unarmed. Boys! Look at them! Lord Carstark looked instead at Catelyn. Tell your mother to look at them, he said. She slew them as much as I. Catelyn put a hand on the back of Rob's seat. The hall seemed to spin about her. She felt as if she might retch. My mother had naught to do with this, Rob said angrily. This was your work, your murder, your treason. How can it be treason to kill Lannisters when it is not treason to free them? Asked Carstark harshly. Has your grace forgotten that we are at war with Castle Rock? In war you kill your enemies. Didn't your father teach you that, boy?
Boy!
The great John dealt Richard Carstark a buffet with a mail fist that sent the other lord to his knees.
Leave him!
Rob's voice rang with command. Umber stepped back away from the captive. Lord Carstark spit out a broken tooth.
Yes, Lord Umber, leave me to the king. He means to give me a scolding before he forgives me. That's how he deals with treason, our king in the north.
He smiled a wet red smile.
Or should I call you the king who lost the north, your grace?
The great John snatched a spear from the man beside him and jerked it to his shoulder.
Let me spit him, sire. Let me open his belly so we can see the colour of his guts.
The doors of the hall crashed open, and the Blackfish entered with water running from his cloak and helm. Tully men-at-arms followed him in, whilst outside lightning cracked across the sky and a hard black rain pounded against the stones of Riverrun. Sir Brynden removed his helm and went to one knee. "Your grace," was all he said, but the grimness of his tone spoke volumes. I will hear Sir Brynden privily in the audience chamber. Rob rose to his feet. Great John, keep Lord Carstark here till I return, and hang the other seven. The Great John lowered his spear.
Even the dead ones?
Yes. I will not have such fouling my lord uncle's rivers. Let them feed the crows. One of the captives dropped to his knees.
Mercy, sire, I killed no one. I only stood at the door to watch for guards.
Rob considered that for a moment. Did you know what Lord Rickard intended? Did you see the knives drawn? Did you hear the shouts, the screams, the cries for mercy?
I did, but I took no part. I was only the watcher. I swear it.
Lord Umber, said Rob, this one was only the watcher. Hang him last, so he may watch the others die. Mother, uncle, with me, if you please. He turned away as the great John's men closed upon the prisoners and drove them from the hall at spear point. Outside the thunder crashed and boomed, so loud it sounded as if the castle were coming down about their ears. Is this the sound of a kingdom falling? Catelyn wondered. It was dark within the audience chamber. But at least the sound of the thunder was muffled by another thickness of wall. A servant entered with an oil lamp to light the fire, but Rob sent him away and kept the lamp. There were tables and chairs, but only Edmure sat, and he rose again when he realized that the others had remained standing.
Rob took off his crown and placed it on the table before him. The blackfish shut the door. The Karstarks are gone.
All?
Was it anger or despair that thickened Rob's voice like that? Even Catelyn was not certain. All the fighting men, Sir Brynden replied. A few camp followers and serving men were left with their wounded. We questioned as many as we needed to be certain of the truth. They started leaving at nightfall, stealing off in ones and twos at first, and then in larger groups. The wounded men and servants were told to keep the campfires lit so no one would know they'd gone, but once the rains began, it didn't matter.
"Will they reform, away from River Run?" asked Rob.
"No. They've scattered, hunting. Lord Karstark has sworn to give the hand of his maiden daughter to any man high-born or low who brings him the head of the Kingslayer."
"Gods be good."
Catelyn felt ill again. "Near 300 riders and twice as many mounts melted away in the night." Rob rubbed his temples, where the crown had left its mark, in the soft skin above his ears. "All the mounted strength of Carhold lost."
"Lost by me. By me, may the gods forgive me."
Catelyn did not need to be a soldier to grasp the trap Rob was in. For the moment he held the Riverlands, but his kingdom was surrounded by enemies to every side but east, where Lysa sat, aloof on her mountaintop. Even the Trident was scarce secure, so long as the Lord of the Crossing withheld his allegiance. And now, to lose the Karstarks as well. "No word of this must leave River Run," her brother Edmure said. "Lord Tywin would, the Lannisters pay their debts. They are always saying that. Mother have mercy when he hears."
"Sansa."
Catelyn's nails dug into the soft flesh of her palms. So hard did she close her hand. Rob gave Edmure a look that chilled. "Would you make me a liar, as well as a murderer, uncle?"
"We need speak no falsehood. Only say nothing. Bury the boys, and hold our tongues till the war's done. Willem was son to Sir Kevin Lannister, and Lord Tywin's nephew. Tien was Lady Jenna's and a Frey. We must keep the news from the twins as well, until we can bring the murdered dead back to life," said Brynden Blackfish sharply. "The truth escaped with the Karstarks, Edmure. It's too late for such games."
"I owe their fathers truth," said Rob. "And justice. I owe them that as well." He gazed at his crown, the dark gleam of bronze, the circle of iron swords. "Lord Rickard defied me, betrayed me. I have no choice but to condemn him. Gods know what the Karstark foot will do with Roose Bolton when they hear I've executed their liege for a traitor. Bolton must be warned." "Lord Karstark's heir was at Harrenhal as well," Sir Brynden reminded him. "The eldest son, the one the Lannisters took captive on the Green Fork."
"Harrion?"
"His name is Harrion." Rob laughed bitterly. "A king had best know the names of his enemies, don't you think?" The Blackfish looked at him shrewdly.
"You know that for a certainty, that this will make young Karstark your enemy?"
"What else would he be? I'm about to kill his father. He's not like to thank me."
"He might. There are sons who hate their fathers, and in a stroke you will make him Lord of Carhold."
Rob shook his head. "Even if Harrion were that sort, he could never openly forgive his father's killer. His own men would turn on him. These are Northmen, uncle. The North remembers."
"Pardon him, then," urged Edmure Tully.
Rob stared at him in frank disbelief. Under that gaze, Edmure's face reddened.
"Spare his life, I mean. I don't like the taste of it any more than you, sire. He slew my men as well. Poor Delp had only just recovered from the wound Sir Jamie gave him. Karstark must be punished, certainly. Keep him in chains, I say."
"A hostage?" said Catelyn.
"It might be best."
"Yes, a hostage."
Her brother seized on her musing as agreement.
"Tell the son that so long as he remains loyal, his father will not be harmed. Otherwise, We have no hope of the Freys now, not if I offer to marry all Lord Waldo's daughters and carry his litter besides. If we should lose the Carstocks as well, what hope is there?
What hope? Rob let out a breath, pushed his hair back from his eyes, and said, We've had naught from Sir Roderick in the north. No response from Waldo Frey to our new offer. Only silence from the Airy. He appealed to his mother. Will your sister never answer us? How many times must I write her? I will not believe that none of the birds have reached her.
Her son wanted comfort, Catelyn realized. He wanted to hear that it would be all right. But her king needed truth.
The birds have reached her, though she may tell you they did not, if it ever comes to that. Expect no help from that quarter, Rob. Lysa was never brave. When we were girls together, she would run and hide whenever she'd done something wrong. Perhaps she thought our Lord Father would forget to be wroth with her if he could not find her. It is no different now. She ran from King's Landing for fear, to the safest place she knows, and she sits on her mountain hoping everyone will forget her.
The Knights of the Vale could make all the difference in this war, said Rob.
But if she will not fight, so be it. I've asked only that she open the Bloody Gate for us, and provide ships at Gulltown to take us north. The high road would be hard, but not so hard as fighting our way up the Neck. If I could land at White Harbour, I could flank Moat Cailin and drive the Iron Men from the north in half a year.
It will not happen, sire, said the Blackfish. Cat is right. Lady Lysa is too fearful to admit an army to the Vale, any army. The Bloody Gate will remain closed.
The others can take her, then, Rob cursed in a fury of despair. Bloody Rickard Carstark as well, and Theon Greyjoy, Waldo Frey, Tywin Lannister, and all the rest of them. Gods be good, why would any man ever want to be a king? When everyone was shouting, King in the North, King in the North, I told myself, swore to myself, that I would be a good king, as honourable as father, strong, just, loyal to my friends, and brave when I face my enemies. Now I can't even tell one from the other. How did it all get so confused? Lord Rickard's fought at my side in half a dozen battles. His sons died for me in the Whispering Wood. Theon Frey and Willem Lannister were my enemies, yet now I have to kill my dead friend's father for their sakes. He looked at them all. Will the Lannisters thank me for Lord Rickard's head? Will the Freys?
No,
said Brynden Blackfish, blunt as ever. All the more reason to spare Lord Rickard's life and keep him hostage, Edmure urged. Rob reached down with both hands, lifted the heavy bronze and iron crown, and set it back atop his head. And suddenly, he was a king again. Lord Rickard dies.
But why? Said Edmure. You said yourself.
I know what I said, uncle. It does not change what I must do. The swords in his crown stood stark and black against his brow. In battle, I might have slain Theon and Willem myself, but this was no battle. They were asleep in their beds, naked and unarmed, in a cell where I put them. Rickard Carstark killed more than a Frey and a Lannister. He killed my honour. I shall deal with him at dawn. When day broke, grey and chilly, the storm had diminished to a steady, soaking rain, yet even so the God's Wood was crowded. River lords and northmen, high-born and low, knights and sellswords and stable-boys, they stood amongst the trees to see the end of the night's dark dance. Edmure had given commands, and a headsman's block had been set up before the heart tree. Rain and leaves fell all around them, as the Great John's men led Lord Rickard Carstark through the press, hands still bound. His men already hung from River Run's high walls, slumping at the end of long ropes, as the rain washed down their darkening faces. Long Lu waited beside the block, but Rob took the poleaxe from his hand and ordered him to step aside. "This is my work," he said. "He dies at my word. He must die by my hand. Lord Rickard Carstark dipped his head stiffly.
For that much I thank you, but for naught else.
He had dressed for death in a long black wool surcoat emblazoned with the white sunburst of his